Well, on behalf of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, we welcome the four candidates here for this hopefully lively and informative discussion and debate. My name is Dirk Rowley. I'm with Wayne 15 News. Caleb Blakesley is the morning host at WoWo Radio, and Fred McKissick is the editorial director at the Journal Gazette. And the three of us have a list of questions that we would like to ask. But before we start with each of you, again, Andy Zay, Wendy Davis, Marlon Stutzman, and Tim Smith, we want each of you to have 60 seconds for an opening statement. And we've randomly drawn the order. Andy, we will start with you.
I rarely start things off with a Z, but good to do that today. Thank you very much for hosting. It's good to be with everybody. I am Andy Zay. I'm a candidate for the 3rd District Congressional seat. A vote for Andy Zay is a vote for a secure border. I support Donald Trump in finishing the southern border, finishing that wall. I asked Governor Holcomb to send National Guard troops down to support Governor Abbott in Texas in securing the border right now, and they are there. A vote for Andy Zay is a vote for lower taxes. I voted to lower Indiana's income tax, the lowest income tax in the country. Indiana has no inheritance tax. I will fight to eliminate our federal inheritance tax and also make the Trump tax cuts permanent. A vote for Andy Zay is a vote for safer communities. I voted for eliminating sanctuary cities and unapologetically backing the blue. I'm happy to have be the candidate with the experience that's casted the votes that will serve you and serve Northeast Indiana.
Thank you, Andy. Wendy Davis.
I'm former judge Wendy Davis, now candidate for the 3rd Congressional District, and I am running to bring back a strong America alongside our next president, Donald Trump. As a judge, the border crisis came to me here in Northeast Indiana. As a judge, I had to react to illegal immigration clogged in my courtroom, fentanyl addicts clogged in my courtroom, illegal drug dealers in my courtroom, and then cultural issues like minor gender changes coming in front of the court. I want to pivot, and I want to be proactive to help solve problems in America. As a judge, I could not kick the can down the road in solving problems in my courtroom. I won't do that in Congress. I will work to make sure we secure the borders, that we get our economy rolling again, that I fight for Hoosier farmers and families, that we get crime under control. I'm former Judge Wendy Davis, and I am now a 3rd congressional candidate. Would love your vote May 7th.
Thank you, Wendy. Marlon Stutzman.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here, and thank you to all of you for helping host the event here at the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. I am Marlon Stutzman, former congressman for the 3rd District here in Northeast Indiana. I served this district from 2010 to 2016. After a failed run for the U.S. Senate, I was happy to come home and to raise our boys. My wife, Christy, and I have two sons, Peyton and Preston. And Peyton is now 22, and Preston is 18. And so as Jim Banks decided to run for Senate, I believe that this is a time again for me to go back to Washington and continue the fight that I started back when I was in office, fighting the establishment, fighting the status quo, fighting the debt, fighting the fact that Washington is working for themselves and not working for the American people. We're seeing higher inflation. We're seeing the cost of living going up. We're seeing the cost of energy rising. The cost to the American people continues to rise. And Washington is the only beneficiary, and it's time for that to stop. So I'm running for Congress to return the values to the American people and not to Washington.
Thank you, Marlon. Tim Smith.
Well, I'm Tim Smith, and it's good to be back at my alma mater, where Mike Downs was my personal advisor first semester freshman year. So that's kind of fun for me to be in the Mike Downs Center. I've been married 34 years to my beautiful wife, Angela. We have 5 adult kids, 17 grandkids, soon to be an 18th, and I just consider myself one of the most blessed guys in the world. I'm running for Congress to end wokeness and expand freedom. Wokeness is anything contributing to the social slide, puberty blockers for kids, gender transition surgeries, CRT in schools. But it's also what the president has done with the Department of Agriculture, where on the USDA website today, racial justice and climate justice are the two top priorities instead of, say, corn, beans, soybeans, or dairy. I'm also running to expand freedom. I believe the border is our first, second, and third biggest problems, followed closely by the debt. I look forward to sharing, over the next hour and a half or so, my ideas on both the border and how we can reduce debt. I'm Tim Smith. I'm running for Congress to end wokeness and expand freedom.
Thank you to the four of you. We'll start with Andy here for the first question, and let's see if we can put some daylight between all of you. If you were to be sent to Washington, and this would be the same question for all four candidates, what committee would you want to serve on that would be the best use of your skills and the most benefit to the 3rd District?
Well, it's a tough question for me. I've served in a lot of capacities as a state senator. Certainly, I have a passion for utilities, and what's being mandated and brought down to our states and our utilities as far as federal overregulation. So I'd have a high interest in utilities. And also being a lifelong business owner, 71 years in the business, following in my grandfather and father's footsteps, I'd be very interested in commerce and technology and those things. But I think what is important to Indiana and Northeast Indiana's Armed Services Committee, the impact of the industrial of the defense industry in Indiana is huge. We host the second largest naval base in southern Indiana and Crane Naval Base. We have a lot of partners up here in Northeast Indiana, which Jim Banks has so appropriately brought together a few times every year with his defense summit. And we need to be on the cusp of that and how we are innovating and using that going forward. And, I think there's a high need for someone from Indiana to be on that. So I would say there's two or three answers in there, but I think those would be my two or three priorities with what I've done in the Senate and what is important in Northeast Indiana.
Wendy Davis, same question. What committees suit you and suit the district?
Three come to mind: appropriations, armed services, and agriculture. So as the circuit court judge, I had to manage three budgets. We have got to get our spending under control in our federal budget. We've got to decrease spending. We have to put a balanced budget amendment on the floor every single year until we get that done. But with the appropriations, I would be in a position, just like I was in circuit court, to make sure we live within our budget and stop needless spending. Armed services as well. I've been the honorary commander out at our local 122nd for the last 5 years. My husband is a lieutenant colonel that is deployable right now. My middle son, who is a West Point grad, is a new young officer in the U.S. Army at Fort Carson. I bring that up because the military is a huge part of our national security. To bring back a strong America, we have to have a strong economy. Appropriations will help me do that. Strong America means strong national security, which I know a lot about. And then lastly, agriculture. Northeast Indiana has a huge agriculture and farming population that we must protect. It's been overregulated. We can't even get a farm bill passed. So I would also look to protect our farmers, because Hoosier farmers feed the world. And I want to make sure that on the Agriculture Committee, we are fighting to open up markets for our farmers. So those three: appropriations to help get spending and balance our budget, armed services to keep a strong national security, and agriculture to protect Northeast Indiana farmers.
Thank you, Wendy. Marlon Stutzman.
Thank you for the question. Obviously, committee work is where a lot of work is done anymore in Washington. When I served in Washington before, I served on the Agricultural Committee, Budget Committee, Veteran Affairs, and also the Financial Services Committee. And that's where work really can be done. I also believe that with my background as a business owner and as a farmer, that all of those committees really did fit my interest and in where I could contribute the most. I would also not only pursue those particular committees, but I would also be interested in the leadership role. Anymore, the problem with Washington is that not only is Washington as a whole is broken, but the committee process, the legislative process in Washington is fundamentally broken. So many decisions are made in the leader's offices, whether it's the Speaker of the House, whether it's the Majority Leader, the Majority Whip always brings these bills together and puts them in front of members and says, okay, you have 3 days to vote on these, and then it's 2 days. I think that's something that I would have a great interest in, because if the process does not work for the members, it doesn't work for the American people. And so while I have the interest in those particular the committees that I mentioned, I would also have a very strong interest in the leadership role to make sure that the process works where members can take an amendment to the floor and have real debate, where we don't build these big Christmas trees and push them in front of the members right before Christmas and say, you got to vote on it, yes or no, and sorry, it's too bad. And ultimately, the American people pay for that.
Thank you. Tim Smith.
Agriculture and budget. I have been really honored to talk to probably 500 farmers, without exaggeration, over the last 6 months across our district. I didn't set out thinking I would want to be in the Agriculture Committee, but the more time I spent with them, the more I realized this is an ag district. and I learned a few things about what is challenging them mostly. Interest rates and inflation, and then regulation. Interest rates and inflation, why? Because of our debt. Why do we have so much debt? Because the government spends and spends and spends. Currently, we're at $35 trillion in debt, or $100,000 for every man, woman, and child, or $250,000 for every taxpayer. That's what we owe in debt. How do we fix it? Cut waste, balanced budget amendment, and what Rand Paul and his father called a penny plan, or now a six-penny plan. I'll elaborate on some of those in a moment, but until we get the debt under control, we don't get inflation or interest rates under control. And regulation. A farmer showed me a nitrogen tank, and he had to spend $16,000 to build a little moat around it. And he said, Tim, if I had the same amount of nitrogen in three tanks, I wouldn't have to have any. Or if I put it on a trailer, I wouldn't have to have any. The government, through too many regulations that don't make sense, which are inappropriately and inconsistently applied, has been crushing our farmers. We need to get the government out of the regulation of ag.
Thank you, Tim. Fred?
Yes. Let's start with Wendy Davis. A recent Gallup survey showed that more than a third of Americans believe we're spending too much on defense, while one in four believes we're not spending enough. What is your stance on defense appropriations, which accounts for, I believe, half of discretionary spending?
Thank you. Well, the federal government needs to be a lot smaller. The federal government's job is to fund our military, fund our defense. That's a part of its job. The problem we have right now is that the government is spending way too much money on things that they need to get out of and get it out of the way. All the needless spending that the Joe Biden administration and others are doing are now creating us to have this conversation where we need to cut spending to defense. Look, I'm running to bring back a strong America. Strong America is a strong national defense. Right now, we've got all these wars raging around the globe and in the Middle East, and we need to have a strong military. And why I say that, and I know this pretty much firsthand, we need to concentrate on funding our military to ensure that our military is ready, that they know how to use weapons and they know how to defend our country, not how to use pronouns. So for me, I think we need to cut spending in a multitude of other ways, and that starts by balancing our budget and funding our military.
Mr. Sussman?
Same question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I we have the strongest, most powerful military in the world, and I am proud of our military men and women who serve our country every day. And the fact that, in most part, the Congress continues to support a strong military, I do believe that considering, you know, as Tim mentioned, we have $35 trillion of debt. Our annual budget runs roughly around $4 trillion annually for the federal government, about $3 trillion in revenue, so that means we're taking on another $1 trillion worth of debt every year, and it's actually faster than that now. The interest on our debt is now going to be more expensive than what we spend on our military. I think we have to take an all-of-the-above approach. Every facet of government has to be looked at and has to be cut. We are putting the American people in a very vulnerable position because our dollar is worth less, the cost of groceries is higher at the grocery store, the cost of gas is higher. It's over $4 now just today when I filled up. Knowing that Washington is out of control. And so military does have to be addressed. As Andy mentioned, being on armed services, that's a place that can be done. I don't ever want to put a person in the military at a vulnerable position because they don't have the equipment or the tools that they need. But I do know from friends of mine who are in the military that if they don't spend their budget, then they won't get the same amount of money back. And I think that's a very bad precedent.
Tim Smith?
I think of defense spending through the lens of an America First policy. It applies to foreign policy. It applies to defense spending. We're currently spending millions of dollars a year on a DEI program at the Defense Department. Look, I want the best, strongest, smartest, fastest people defending our country. I don't care what gender you are, I don't care what race you are, what religion you are. We shouldn't be spending millions of dollars on things in the Defense Department that make no sense. If I'm in Congress, I'm going to be offering an amendment, as Jim Banks did in the past year, to eliminate that kind of funding. What has our defense spending gotten us in the last 25 years? We spent $3 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan over about 20 years. $3 trillion. That's almost as much as our annual budget. Vietnam, we spent a lot of money. More importantly, lost a lot of men and women. Iraq, same thing. What a botched Afghanistan withdrawal. We couldn't even get that investment right in the White House. Iran. President Obama and Joe Biden gave Iran $400 million in cash. They unfroze $150 billion of Iranian assets across the globe. Where did it go? To Hamas and Hezbollah. What has happened? They attack Israel. You ask about defense funding, funding and spending? How about we start by viewing it through an America First lens and have a strategy that makes sense?
Andy Zinn.
Fred, thank you very much for the question. First of all, we need to consider this as an overall vision of our country. When there's a strong America, the world is at peace. What we have now is a flailing America with no peace in the Middle East, no peace in Europe. And America needs the lead. We need an executive branch that is building networks with other world leaders to put peace in place. In regards to specific spending and how that goes, if we get the federal government back in its lane, one charge of our federal government, a big charge of our federal government, is national security. So we need to make sure that our tangible investments in national security are intentional to keep our country safe, as in securing our southern border and knowing who's coming here, as to be a good partner in other parts of the world and promote peace throughout the world. But also, we need to let American ingenuity take off. The bureaucracy of our Defense Department, internally and externally, is a clog. It's a slow-moving wheel where we're seeing other countries pass by us because we are not innovating quickly enough. We're working off very old equipment. We're working off supply lines that are diminished and failing. We need to rebuild our military and make it as strong and as innovative as it's ever been in the history of America. And when we do that, there will be peace in the world.
Thank you.
All right, let's continue the money conversation, shall we? Marlon, get ready. This one's coming to you first. Specifically, let's talk about foreign spending versus domestic spending. A lot of foreign spending has been committed to Ukraine and Israel. Could this money be better spent back in the United States, or do you see a value in sending money overseas to places like Ukraine and Israel? Furthermore, how would you have voted on the foreign aid bill that passed 2 months ago out of the Senate? Marlon, it's to you.
Yeah, first of all, I would not support funding to Ukraine. I don't believe that's a place that we should be spending hard-earned taxpayer dollars. I believe that we should be focusing on the southern border. We have an invasion here in our own country. There's no tanks coming across, but there are people coming across that do wish death to America. We have to finish the wall, seal our border. My theory has always been we have to have a high wall and a wide gate. We have to have a system that works for the American people and not continue to be the funders for the rest of the world. I'm rooting for Ukraine. I am, but I'll tell you what. One of the things, Kayla, that could have happened is that, and this is where I go back to why I support President Trump, because he is the type of person that goes right into the enemy. He went into North Korea, went into Kim Jong-un and met him face-to-face and stared him down. We did not have any sort of activity like we see Russia attacking Ukraine when President Trump was president. And that's why I believe that President Trump should be reelected, because America is a safer place with a strong executive. Andy touched on that a little bit because, you know, we're talking about how much money we spend on our military. A lot of this could be done straight from the White House. And we have a weak leader in the White House, and we need a president who's going to go right into our enemy and say, look, we're not going to be spending millions and billions of dollars frivolously. Lives are lost. Let's make sure that we keep peace rather than allowing a dictator in Russia to be running around Eastern Europe causing problems. And so, again, it takes strong leadership from the White House.
Thank you, Marlon. Tim Smith, same question.
The Constitution says that every spending bill in America must originate in the House. Not the White House, the House of Representatives. That's the way it's supposed to work. And we're supposed to pass budgets which stipulate how much we're going to spend in various areas. We haven't done that for years in terms of getting all of them done at one time. Speaker Johnson is trying. Foreign versus domestic is really easy for me. Ukraine, really easy. I'm a hard no. Israel, I'm a yes. The bill that just came out of the Senate, a hard no. We have to get our spending under control. We have given Ukraine over $100 billion to date, just to date. And now they want to give them 65 more. By contrast, the Farm Bill, which is a five-year piece of legislation, from 2018 to 2023, was about $100 billion a year, $500 billion over 5 years. About 80% of that goes to a food stamp program called SNAP, leaving every farmer in America with only $20 billion a year. And what do they do with it? Crop insurance, conservation, young farmers programs, etc. Folks, every farmer in America was sharing $20 billion. We just gave Ukraine over $100 billion, and the liberals in Congress want to give them more. We need to advocate for agriculture. We need to advocate for domestic issues like the border and not Ukraine. Unlike President Biden, I care more about our border than Ukraine's border.
Tim, thank you. Andy Zay, coming to you.
Kayla, thank you very much for the question. As we discussed on the radio a few weeks ago, it is important that we separate these bills and have standalone conversations and let the debate go on about Ukraine, about Israel, and most importantly, about our southern border. It is high time with the attack going on in America, 11 million illegal immigrants coming into our country. Let's go back a few years at the 9/11. 20 folks came to our country, learned how to fly here, and turned on us, and had the worst domestic terrorist attack in the United States of America. To think that that wouldn't happen today is to be naive. We have a huge challenge before us with our homeland security, with everything that has been undone in the last 3 years. We need strong leadership, and we need to commit to that leadership by funding our southern border and creating protection and creating security here at home. A dictator in Ukraine, it is no time to fund them. That is where the world needs to step up. NATO needs to do their job. We need to stand with NATO to make sure that they have the support they need to push back on Putin. And Israel is not asking for more money. They're asking for continued support of what we have. They're not asking to increase funding, and I think we need to play a role in that. The rockets shot at them this last week were rockets that were not shot at Americans. So they are the defender of democracy in that part of the country, and we need to stand with them.
Andy, thank you. Last but not least, Wendy, to you.
Thank you, Kayla. Yeah, well, to bring back a strong America means that we know who our allies are and we know who our enemies are. So as far as foreign spending and domestic, let me just get out of the way. The foreign bill that was just passed, I'm a hard no on that. Foreign spending, Ukraine and Israel. I stand with Israel. I think America has to stand with Israel. Israel is our ally. Like I said, we have to stand with our allies. We are fighting the same enemy, which is Iran, Hamas, which is funded by Iran. So we need to stand by Israel and ensure that they have what they need to win their war. Ukraine, you know, Joe Biden has botched this up. Donald Trump gave Ukraine weapons to deter the war in Ukraine. Biden has just given them a blank check and just thrown money at that war, so not one more cent to Ukraine. Domestically, we need to secure our southern border. We've got to secure our southern border. I saw it firsthand in my courtroom. Illegals coming in, they would tell me stories of how they got to Northeast Indiana. We've got to secure our southern border because that border has come to us here in Northeast Indiana. And we've got to make sure our economy, we need to make sure that we get energy, bring back energy independence, make sure we are fracking and drilling and doing whatever we need to do to be energy independent. Right now, we are spending money and buying gas and oil from our enemies. So currently, I think we need to aid Israel. I believe that politically, and I also believe that through my faith.
Thank you, Wendy. Dirk, you're up.
Tim Smith, question to you. Last week, former President Trump said abortion should be left to the states, and he did not press for a national ban. Do you agree with him?
Well, I am unapologetically pro-life and proud to be. This has been one of the most important issues to me for a long time. Endorsed by the Indiana Right to Life, endorsed by Northeast Indiana Right to Life. This is the A issue. It is the most important issue. If there's no life, not much else matters. The Dobbs decision delegated to the states and legislators and legislatures this authority. They didn't just delegate it to the states, and so Congress has a role as well. I'm adamantly pro-life, can't wait to discuss and legislate on pro-life issues. The president gave us three Supreme Court justices, which gave us the Dobbs decision. I can't tell you how many Right to Life marches I've marched in my life. I will be happy and am looking forward to voting yes on any pro-life legislation in Congress, period. Any pro-life legislation in Congress. If you said to me, Dirk, you could eliminate all abortions over X number of weeks, I'd say sign me up. I prefer that there's no abortions, but if I can limit it some way, count me as a yes vote to limit it some way. This is probably the most important issue to me because without life, not much else matters.
Tim Smith, thank you. Andy Zay, same question.
Well, thank you very much for the question, Dirk, and I'm the only one that's voted for life and where we stand today. We called ourselves back into session after the Dobbs decision. We were the first state to advocate and stand for life. And after a week of being spit on, cussed at, escorted out of the state house in between meetings, life matters. And life matters here in Indiana, and we've shown that, we've proven that. And that's why we are a state that has decreased abortions by 95% here in the state. In fact, I stood with Attorney General Todd Rokita last week because of our legislation that was ruled constitutional, the Department of Health changed their position in doing some reporting that they were doing as to holding our abortion doctors accountable in the state of Indiana. Attorney General Rokita and myself, he made the decision, the legal opinion, that they need to continue to do that because we still need to be champions for life. And now the movement for life begins. It's creating that culture for life, bringing the business community along to show that people that support life are good workers and show up for work, to show communities that people that are pro-life are good community citizens and will show up and be a part of our communities. I believe in life. I've voted for life, and I'm supported by many who have fought this cause for 50 years.
Thank you, sir. Wendy Davis, National Ban on Abortion.
So I am also unapologetically a pro-life Christian. I will fight for life. Life starts at conception. I also have been endorsed by Northeast Indiana Right to Life, Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, and also Indiana Right to Life. So the Dobbs decision, basically, if you read the decision, it hands it back to the people, the Congress and states' rights. Although I'm a states' rights gal, I will fight for life, whether it's on the federal level or the state level. And I believe the Dobbs decisions allows us to do that. However, I think what we really need to be worried about is the Democrats right now have legislation that would allow a baby to be aborted up until the minute that baby is born at taxpayer expense. So as your next U.S. Congresswoman, I will fight for life at the federal level to ensure that that kind of legislation doesn't get through. So although I'm a states' rights gal, let's be clear about that Dobbs decision. It allows Congress to take up the issue of life. And as the next Congresswoman, if that comes my way, or if I want to be the one that, to help make sure we fight for life on the national stage, I absolutely will. But Indiana got it right here. And so we need that. I mean, if I could ban abortion, I would ban abortion as well. So I will fight for life and fight against the Democrats to preserve every single life I can.
Marlon Stutzman.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And again, this I agree with Tim. This is the most important issue for all of us as Americans, and that is the right to life. Indiana is a strong pro-life state, and I did vote for pro-life legislation, carried pro-life legislation when I was in the State House and also in Congress. And I'm very proud of the fact that Indiana did lead the way on becoming one of the first states to ban abortion after the Dobbs decision. I agree with the Dobbs decision. I believe that it is the state's rights, as we should be consistent across the board, what's the federal government's role and what's the state government's role. Sadly, the problem in Washington, and being there for 6 years and seeing the abortion industry and the abortion lobbyists, this is the issue that now divides the Democrat Party and the Republican mm-hmm. Party. You would think, well, why wouldn't it be economic issues? Why wouldn't it be foreign policy issues? Instead, the Democrats, and I had a Democrat friend from Chicago who was pro-life, the Democrats went after him in a primary and defeated him. There are hardly, if there's any pro-life Democrats in the Democrat Party, I am not aware of it. It is basically a pro-abortion party, and sadly, that's what divides the parties anymore. And so I will continue to fight for life. I'm the only candidate endorsed by all the major Right to Life organizations, including Students for Life, I will continue to fight it. Having a personal story with my mom, who was 17 years old when she was pregnant with me, I know that life is precious, and I'm very thankful for it.
Fred?
Yes. What specific initiatives do you have to support agricultural interest in rural communities within this district? Let's start with Andy Zine.
Well, I think a big thing is pulling back on regulation. Farmers need to be able to farm. And when you look at the farm bill, we have burdened that with social welfare and social programs. And though those may be important, I think we need to separate them and debate them on their merits. Our farmers need the support. Our farmers need to know that they have the support. They're under the attack from so many different means, whether it's the federal government and their regulation, whether it's the some of the food folks that are attacking them and how we're making food. We've got to look at, I think it's Proposition 12 out of California, and have fair interstate commerce, where we're getting the PETA folks out of LA that are dictating how our farmers in Indiana and how much space our pigs need to raise. I think our farmers know that, because that's their livelihood in those pens. And we know how to raise animals, and we know how to feed the world. We do that very well here in Indiana. And so it's supporting the farmers and getting the federal regulation off their back, and allowing them to be successful and be a part of our communities.
Wendy Davis?
So a strong America means strong farmers. Like I said earlier, Hoosier farmers feed the world, and they need the tools to ensure that they can feed the world. So initiatives to help the farmers in Congress would be, we've got to have a good, strong farm bill that has passed. I mean, right now, that farm bill should have been passed a year ago, but they kicked the can down the road. Like I said, as a judge, I was unable to do that. We need to make sure that we stop all this needless spending at the federal government, because it's making inputs so high and costly for our farmers. We need to become energy independent. We need to support, as the next Congresswoman, I will support ethanol, renewable energy. These kind of things are very important to our Hoosier farmers. I've seen two ethanol plants here in Northeast Indiana, and these farmers right now, because Joe Biden has closed down a lot of the free markets, they rely on the ethanol plants to sell their corn, which is another thing. Under Donald Trump, he had great trade agreements with the for the farmers. For instance, he had USMCA, which was a trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, that the farmers could make sure that's an open market so that they can sell their grain. We need to also make sure the EPA gets off the back of our livestock production. I've been so blessed that I've been on cattleman farm, I've been on poultry farms. I used to represent a poultry operation before I took the bench. But we need to make sure, right now the EPA has lawsuits trying to shut down livestock production. We need to fight for that in Congress.
All right, thank you. Marlon Stutzman,
yeah, thank you. Question. I want to circle back real quick to the Ukraine-Israel question, because I didn't answer on Israel. And I do support funding, or not even additional funding, just continue to stand with Israel. We've been a great partner. They are our greatest ally in the Middle East, and we've helped them build the Iron Dome system, David Sling. And also, the other point I wanted to point out was that President Trump led the Abraham Accords in the Middle East, and that is a huge, huge deal, where other Arab countries are supporting Israel in defending themselves. And so I wanted to just make sure I was on record for that. When it comes to farming, I'm a farmer. I grew up on a farm. I grew up walking seed corn fields and tasseling corn. I know how difficult it is to farm. I tell you, the American farmer is the most productive farmer in the world. We not only feed ourselves, but we feed greater parts of the world. I have a different take on this when it comes to the Farm Bill. Like Tim mentioned before, the Farm Bill is primarily 80% welfare programs, 20% farm programs. I fought while I was in Congress to divide those two and have a separate vote on them, because why should we be forced to vote for a large welfare program and also support farmers? I believe in a free enterprise. I believe in the free market. I believe that we could, because of our debt and our deficits, this would be a place as a farmer that I would actually pursue in eliminating spending into agriculture. Let's let the free market work. Agriculture is it's a tough industry, but it also has treated my family very well and treated many farmers around Northeast Indiana very well. We don't need the subsidies into agriculture like we used to. We need to move away from that. Save those taxpayer dollars for the American taxpayer, reduce the debt and deficit, and let's let the free market work rather than have government involved in agriculture more and more.
Thank you, Mr. Sussman. Tim? Tim Smith, finally.
Food security is national security, and it's a lot more than just five words. It seems almost cliche. Food security is national security. I'm 55 years old. Never one time in my life have I wondered whether America would produce enough food to feed America. Not one time. Until I ran for Congress and I started learning more about the threats to the agricultural community in the United States. China is buying up land left and right. Solar farms are taking up land left and right. We are losing land. Regulations are killing farmers. I stood with a farmer on two of his plots, 120-acre plots recently. One was flat, one had a lot of undulation, ran down to a creek. He told me a story. The prior fall, he put down fertilizer. Late that day, 2 inches of rain. The next day, up comes IDEM, the people who test the chemicals in the water. They go down to the ditch, in a little pipe underneath the road, and they test. And guess what? The field with hills tested too high. Well, he didn't want it to test it too high. He wanted the fertilizer actually in the crops. But because the field had undulation, the reading was too high. So he was in trouble. Our regulations don't even make sense for our farmers. Food security is national security. We tell them to build dikes around nitrogen tanks unless they're bringing that on wheels. We tell them to put down so much fertilizer unless it's undulated. We have to treat our farmers with common sense in terms of how we regulate them. We're not today.
Thank you. Okay.
Wendy, this one's coming to you. We're going to continue talking about money. Specifically, would you support a blind trust for U.S. representatives and senators to ensure that any knowledge unique to them is not used for their own personal gain, a.k.a. insider trading? Furthermore, what can we do to prevent even the appearance of insider trading?
Right. So I think it the question is, would I support a blind trust? Okay. So I do believe, when I look at Washington right now and all the failed career politicians and career politicians that are in Washington, D.C., there is no transparency. It seems to me like people are going to Washington, D.C. and making a lot of money, and the American people don't really know why. I think there definitely has to be more transparency for the inside knowledge that I have. Obviously, I went to law school. I've got a lot. I don't know what that would be used for, but any kind of knowledge that I would get as a congresswoman, we have to make sure that I cannot use that to benefit myself personally. And I think there's a lot of that going on right now in Washington, D.C. We need really honest, strong people that are going to stand up and say, I am here as a representative of the 3rd Congressional District. That is what I'm focused on. I'm not focusing on my own personal gain, which I think a lot of the career politicians that are there right now, that's what's happening. We've seen it. We've seen the news articles. So I think Congress needs to work really hard to start creating ways that the American people knows exactly what my salary is, exactly where all my money's coming from, and if I've got any kind of quote-unquote insider information that I am not allowed to use it for my own personal gain. I feel pretty strongly about that.
Wendy, thank you. Marlon, same question about insider trading.
Yeah, insider trading for any politician is illegal. We passed the Stock Act back when I was in Congress, and I supported it and voted for it. There are politicians like Nancy Pelosi and her husband who have enriched themselves off of the information that they have access to. I believe specifically, if you're in those upper echelons of leadership, you have access to even more information than the member, you know, the backbench member, because there should be more scrutiny and more oversight on those particular members, because they do have those meetings with the CEOs from Fortune 500 companies. I think that it's ironic that there's actually an app out there that people can follow the trading of Paul Pelosi and watch them and how they trade. I think that it's important, you know, where for me, I made up our money in agriculture and manufacturing here in Indiana. I was in Washington, D.C. to fight for American values, the Hoosier values, and fight for the American people. I was focused on the budget and how do we cut spending? How do we eliminate waste? How do we protect America? How do we finish the southern border? Those are the issues that we should be focused on. Too many times, in fact, I heard it on an elevator one time as I was leaving the House floor. Other members were talking about whether they were going to run again for office. The wrong people in Washington are there to enrich themselves. And this particular person said, I'm going to run another time because my pension is almost at this point. That is the wrong reason to run for office and to serve the American people. We need to serve the people. Remember, it's hearts of service that are going to make a difference and not people that are going to go to Washington to enrich themselves.
Thank you, Marlon. Tim Smith, coming at you, Insider Trading.
Average Americans look at people in Congress and wonder, how do they leave way wealthier than they went in? I hear it all the time, actually. It's not a mystery. Whatever Congress has passed in the past clearly hasn't worked. Pelosi has gotten rich because of her husband. She's not the only one, by the way. Republicans and Democrats both do it. We don't need people elected to Congress who will find the salary as the best salary they've ever had. Frankly, Congress makes a lot. $175,000, $180,000. That is a whole lot more than most people in Northeast Indiana make. It's a lot. But it doesn't allow you, living in Washington, D.C., to leave with $10, $15, $20 million. And so average people wonder, how does this happen? Answer, insider trading. Average people also wonder, well, why do these PACs and super PACs give so much money to members of Congress? Well, it's pretty simple. Because the money those members of Congress take home to their districts in the form of pork is ridiculous. A line item veto used to be a discussion when I went to this university back in the 80s. It was all the rage. It would have allowed the president to strike pork from bills. Pork is what's contributing to our debt. Pork is what's contributing to our deficit. Average people wonder, how do they get rich? Answer, insider trading. How do bills get passed? Answer, pork. Average people are tired of people going to D.C. and loving the fame and loving the popularity and loving the money. We don't need to elect anybody else where this is the best job they've ever had.
Thank you, Tim. Andy, last but not least, you're up.
Thank you very much for the question. In short, absolutely. We need to have a blind trust when we run for office, when you begin to hold office. In fact, running for office is very expensive. My compliance team spent over a month last year filling out my financial disclosure statements, which goes all the way down to our kids' 529 statements and any statement where we received over $200 in applicable dividends. And I thought that was very revealing. So that kind of transparency and public transparency needs to continue to be available so I am held accountable as a congressman. And in short, absolutely, we have to have a blind trust. We should not be able to trade once I'm a member of Congress. That should be locked up, and you know, it just needs to be done that way. Because you should not, it's running for office is public service. We need the public's trust to support that. And benefiting from that financially is not why I'm involved in this, why I'm currently a state senator, and not why I want to be a U.S. congressman.
Thank you, Andy.
Marlon Stutzman, this question is yours first. Social Security expected to be insolvent by 2034. Every serious fix involves either raising taxes or limiting benefits, such as raising the retirement age. How would you fix Social Security? Which of those two is a better option?
Well, thank you for the question. And Social Security is one of the, it is the largest government program, Medicare being number two. And that's where predominantly most of the taxpayer funding goes into those two programs. We actually proposed solutions 10 years ago when I was in Washington to save Social Security, keep the commitments to those who had already put their money in. We actually had set the threshold at 55. And so those who were 55 and above at that time would have no changes to Social Security. Those who were 55 and below would get their money back that they had invested, but then they would have other solutions or other private sector solutions that they could invest their own money into for their own retirement. I don't believe that the federal government should be our only retirement program. When I was 18 years old, I started my own IRA because I don't believe that Social Security is going to be solvent for me when I retire. But at the same time, for those who have paid in, we have to keep those commitments to them. And so this can be done over a 10-year period of time. It doesn't have to be done overnight. What I fear is that Washington is not going to bring the American people a solution to how we fix the problems, and instead they're going to let it come to a crash when people are going to lose all of their savings that they put into the Social Security program.
Tim Smith, same question. Raising taxes or limiting benefits? What's the better fix to Social Security?
In 1983, I was watching the McNeil-Laird NewsHour with my dad. You might think, well, that's a pretty narrow memory. Like, this sounds like a made-up answer. Well, actually, five nights a week we did all through high school. It's what formed much of my policy. And it was the time that President Reagan and Tip O'Neill, the very liberal Speaker of the House, with a pretty conservative president, were doing exactly this. They were reforming Social Security. And the reason it was memorable is because the story headline was Social Security fixed for all those retiring in 2035 or after. And I did the quick math. Well, that was me. 2035 was my retirement year. And I had just kind of gotten less benefits. It was fair to me because I really hadn't yet started paying in. This is easy. Social Security and Medicare are contracts the government has made with people. I've been paying in. Everybody in this room has been paying in for a long time. They said to me, Tim, you pay X, we'll give you Y. The government doesn't break its contracts with people. Debits and credits are the only way to improve these things. Dirk, you said it. You're right. I'm real clear. This is real simple. I don't support any tax increases, revenue raises to fix these things. The government doesn't have a revenue problem. They have a spending problem. So I will not support any fix that either violates the contract or requires more revenue. I will 100% support fixes like Reagan and O'Neill did, which change benefits 50 years from now for people who haven't yet started paying in. Their contracts haven't yet started.
Andy Zay, same question. Which way to fix Social Security?
Well, the easy answer again is no and no. No, we will not reduce benefits, and no, we will not raise taxes. But think about the question you're asking. The question is asking is something is ultimately broke that we've turned over to the federal government. And I think, as has already been shared, we need to honor the contract with the American people and people that have paid into the Social Security system and the benefits that have been promised. But the whole concept of Social Security needs to be rethought out. And it's going to take some heavy lifting. It's going to require the federal government to get back in its lane. It's going to have to require paring down some of our spending, getting the federal government out of things like education, energy, the Farm Bill, as we've talked about, with regulation, and paring down those agencies. Because we need to reprioritize where we're investing our funds. And a strong national security and supporting up programs like Social Security that continues into the future for our elderly and the promises that were made. It is heavy lifting. It is hard lifting. But we can't continue to turn to the federal government for solutions and the problems that they've created. We simply have had legislatures, we've had presidents for years that can't keep their hands out of that box. And that box was meant to be created by the funds that we've put in and then handing them out when we get to get of age to retire.
Wendy Davis, fixing Social Security, two bad options probably. Which one do you prefer?
I will never vote to raise taxes as your next congresswoman, and so I don't support either raising taxes or limiting benefits. I have to tell a quick story. When I was a judge a couple of years ago, sitting on the bench, I had a guy who I diverted from the jail on the ankle bracelet because our jail didn't have space for him. He comes into my courtroom, and I said, okay, where are you working? He said, oh, Judge Davis, I haven't had a job for 3 years. And I said, well, how do you get your income? This is what he said to me, and I quote, my two kids are on Social Security, and I'm fighting, and I'm appealing my Social Security. So clearly right now, the federal government is handing out money and entitlements that should not be going to half the people that are getting them. I do agree that people that are paying into the Social Security system, that is a contract, legal contract with the federal government that we've got to make sure we do good on. Right now, I think so much needless spending. How we can fix Social Security is to fix our budget, right? So if we can put a balanced budget amendment on the floor, quit spending needless spending, we don't really need to fix Social Security. Social Security will fix itself with a very strong economy and a balanced budget. But right now, what I have seen is a complete abuse of some of these systems. And the older people right now and the people that are paying into it that deserve Social Security, we've got to make sure they get their Social Security.
Thank you, four.
Yes. All four of you have conveyed here that the border crisis is, you know, the most paramount issue in America right now, or one of the two most, at least. What proposals do you have regarding comprehensive immigration reform? And let's start with Tim Smith.
I have eight. Does that surprise you?
No. Not after the McNair-Lair report thing earlier.
Look, finish the wall, that's easy. President Biden literally auctioned off parts that President Trump had lying beside the wall until Biden decided 2.5 years later that maybe finishing a 5 or 6 mile stretch was a good idea. Finish the wall, enforce the laws. I'm a small business owner. If If I hire an illegal today, I'm subject to a $50,000 fine. Let's just enforce the laws that exist. President Biden said famously he needed another law. He doesn't. Here's how we should change it. We should deputize every police officer in America. Make them border agents. Give them the power to arrest and deport. If you're a sanctuary city in America, you're part of the problem. You get no more federal dollars, not education, not transportation, nothing. We send the military to the border immediately. We send 10,000 more ICE agents to the border immediately. And we say, you have to be a U.S. citizen to vote, period. I don't think it's a mystery why Biden and the Democrats want an open border. I think it's pretty straightforward. They want more Democratic votes. If they can turn Texas blue, for example, it's going to be very difficult for a Republican to win the White House ever again. Eight specific policies for what we need to do at the border, and I think they're all pretty easy, at least in concept.
Okay. Andy Zip, please.
Yeah, thank you very much for the question, Fred. And I think the genesis of your question is, what are we doing on the other side of the wall? And that's what we have here. We have a strong economy in some regards. We are still the economic power of the world. Everybody wants to do business with and or for the United States of America. We need to look what's going on within our own borders in that immigration policy. I think the reality is we can't move to that until we secure the border, because we need to know why people are here and what their intent is of being here. If they want to come to our institutions of higher learning to become a part of our economy, we need to enable that. We need to look at increasing our visas to make that more accessible. That's been stagnant for over 20 years. And the reality is we have a workforce that we're not sustaining in America. We're only birthing 1.2 children. And I guess I feel like I've done my job. I have five, so we're getting there. But it's going to take folks from other parts of the world to come in and help us in our technological space and to do that. How are we going to do that? We need to seriously look at our immigration laws. And certainly securing the border is a big deal. We got to recreate the Ellis Island concept of having a wide gate of people coming in, but knowing why they're coming here. I couldn't go to a nursing home or a school without having a background to check on me. And nor should these people be coming into our country without that either.
Okay. Wendy Davis.
Thank you. So as far as the border crisis and immigration reform, look, we need to finish the wall, put back in place Remain in Mexico. We need amnesty reform that's currently in our immigration system. I believe that if you are here illegally, you need to go back to where you came from. So if you're not here legally, you need to go back. And we have to make sure that we are enforcing. Sanctuary cities are illegal. We should not have sanctuary cities, and in Congress, federal government should not give any money to these cities that are calling themselves sanctuary cities. Look, when I took the bench 14 years ago, ICE officers would come and actually pick up illegals, because the way that the law is written right now, that is, if you commit a crime and you're arrested for a felony, ICE comes and picks you up and deports you. Fast forward, what in my courtroom now? There was not one ICE officer that would come and pick up these illegals, because Joe Biden and this administration has wiped out our immigration system altogether, as well as ICE. So I, as the judge, had to give an illegal drug dealer, a public defender, an interpreter, because they don't speak English, they speak Spanish, and I gave him his due process. And I called Troy, and I said, our sheriff, and I said, okay, now I gave him due process, and now he's guilty of dealing fentanyl. Will ICE come pick him up? He said, Judge Davis, ICE will not come pick up any illegals that are in my jail the way they used to. So right now, under this administration, we need a strong Congress and a strong president like Donald Trump to put back into place everything I outlined at the beginning of my argument. Because even way, way back, 18 years ago, when I represented some agriculture industry, they wanted migrant workers. We were able to give them work visas. Fast forward now, illegals in my courtroom couldn't even get a work visa. So we need to go back to, if we want people to come in the front door, not through the border, we go ahead and get them the work visas if they need them in agriculture or any other small business.
Thank you.
Paying attention.
Marlon Stutzman.
Yes. Thank you. I do believe that the top issue for Americans is the economy and the cost of life, the cost of living. But the border obviously is playing a role in that, and costing more. You know, it's unfathomable to think that we have a president of the United States that has allowed at least 7 million people cross the border illegally. I did visit the border wall in Yuma, Arizona, a couple of months ago, and it was truly astonishing to see that this is a humanitarian crisis. You know, women and children, you know, want to come to America. People want to come to America. I understand that, but they need to come through the legal port of entry. They should not be basically cargo coming up from South America, Central America. We know they're coming from China. We know they're coming from the Middle East. We know that there are people coming into the United States illegally who want to do harm to Americans. Now, the fact that there are others that's not their aim, they are then the victims. So women are raped at the border. Children are separated from their parents. The President Biden is doing a disservice to those people by leaving the border open, because now they're separated and who knows where their life is going to go. I believe we have to finish the wall. You know, all of these other things I would agree with. I think that one of the ways that we take the political football away from the Democrats is to say that if a person comes here illegally, they will never have the right to vote, because that's the reason why they have an open border. This is political politics for them, and I think we need to seal the border, focus on that, and then we can start focusing on the other issues on how to solve those.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, bringing it back here a little bit closer to home. Andy, we're going to begin with you. Hundreds of rural hospitals, including here in the Hoosier State, are in immediate danger of shutting down due to several financial problems. Specifically, we see due to failing profits and the amount of net patient revenue. So should the federal government do something to try and help? If so, why or why not?
I think they've done a plenty. Thanks, Kayla, for the question. It's called the Affordable Care Act, which has become unaffordable and an unmitigated disaster for most of the healthcare system. What we've seen is insurance companies embolden themselves to the point of where they don't even participate in the reform processes of health insurance. We've seen health systems grow expansively way, way beyond whatever the intent was. We're seeing rural hospitals and rural healthcare. We're calling them rural health deserts in Indianapolis, and how we're creating opportunity and access to some of our rural communities to that health. So there's a have and have nots within our health system that we spend a lot of time on in Indianapolis and trying to do our part. But there is certainly a federal role in that, and that is, again, pulling back this regulation, allowing our doctors to be reimbursed for a fair value, for a fair rate for their work, and getting the government and insurance companies out of the relationship between the doctor and the patient. Every time you call for prior authorization, the first answer is always no when you talk to the health insurance company. That is a relationship between the doctor and the patient and the care that they need. We have got to pull back. We've got to empower patients to be the consumers and buyers of healthcare, and we've got to empower our doctors to do their jobs. And I think we've emboldened insurance companies, and I think we've emboldened large healthcare systems that have made all this a mess. And we sit here now in Northeast Indiana as one of the highest healthcare states in the country.
Thank you, Andy. Wendy, same question.
So a really strong America is the old saying, no government is no government, right? Having no government is having no government, meaning the federal government should not be involved in our healthcare system at all. We are a country that was founded on capitalism and free enterprise. Obamacare was an absolute joke. And again, that goes into the spending problem we have here in America. I think when I go to get my healthcare, it should be like me wanting to go get a new car, right? I'm going to shop around. People are going to make dicker with me, and I'm going to get the right car for the right price. Healthcare should be the exact same way with no government interference. I understand these rural areas need hospitals bad, but the answer is not the federal government funding them. The answer is free market and free competition. So I would not support any federal government in our healthcare system. Like I said, Obamacare has shown us that I had people in my courtroom that could not get health care because Obamacare was in their way. And unfortunately, a lot of the people I saw in my courtroom that needed health care, even veterans, I ran a veterans court, they couldn't get the health care they needed. So we need to take care of our veterans, but the federal government needs to stay out of private health care.
Wendy, thank you. Marlon, to you.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's sad to hear, you know, the LaGrange County Hospital is closing up services to a community, the Amish community, that would desperately need. There's birthing centers in other parts. There will, people will find a solution, but it's unfortunate when you hear, especially rural communities, that are discontinuing services. And I point that all back to regulations, pointing it back to the federal government. The federal government is more involved in our healthcare system than ever before. You know, it used to be where community hospitals could survive, and we had doctors who were willing to serve in those particular areas. So I believe that we're going to have to empower the patient. We have to empower the people to be able to choose, and then that provides the best services. Here in the Fort Wayne area, we have competition within our hospital systems, but at the same time, they're very powerful. They continue to buy up hospitals around the surrounding areas. They're trying to make the economics work because the government has made it difficult. And so, whether it's health savings accounts, which I support, medical sharing plans has also been another solution for individuals to keep the cost of health care down. And also, I believe that the states need to be more involved rather than the federal government. This shouldn't be a federal government one-size-fits-all solution.
Marlon, thank you. Tim?
You asked if the federal government should spend more money on something. Kayla, when you run for Congress, you get that question all the time. Will you support my project? We're $35 trillion in debt. Every man, woman, and child owes $100,000 apiece. Every taxpayer owes $250,000 apiece. No, we don't have the money to send to Ukraine. No, we don't have the money to spend $200 million on gender assignment, as the last bill included, the minibus omnibus, which ordinary people don't even understand what those things mean. That's congressional speak. But you asked about healthcare. A quick story. I needed a CT scan recently, and I asked the doctor who was, signing me up to get one, well, how much is this going to cost? And the doctor said, well, I have no idea. What do you mean? You're telling me I need one. You have no idea. Well, you just go to our place and get your CT scan. Well, the answer was $1,300. Instead, I called around. I have a $5,000 deductible, like a lot of people. I got it done for $450. We have too many pigs at the healthcare trough. That's the problem. We lack transparency. We have too many pigs at the trough. A pharmaceutical company's profit pre-COVID was $20 billion. The next year, it was $120 billion. Because the federal government, when getting involved in healthcare, decided that all of us had to get shots. And they used OSHA, a federal agency, to make sure we did, or they held our employers accountable. No, no more federal money for another pet project.
Tim, thank you.
I don't often get to deliver good news. There's three questions left. So thank you all for your patience and your continued answers. This is a kind of non-traditional question. Wendy, we'll start with you. I'm going to ask you to speak from the heart. As you run here and travel the 3rd District, what person or group do you see with a heartbreaking challenge that you would want to help as a U.S. representative?
Sure. So it's hard for me. When I was the circuit court judge, I ran 3 problem-solving courts, which in not court speak, it's low-level, non-violent felons that get arrested for possession of a syringe, which is a low-level felony. And the most heartbreaking thing that I've seen is fentanyl addicts and families of fentanyl addicts that have died, and I've seen them in my courtroom. And so personally, we've got to make sure, that's why closing the border and running for Congress, I could only react to those things by trying to get them rehabilitated and trying to give them the services that they need. Healthcare, it was hard. It was hard to get those services paid for. So that's number one. Number two, I talked to a small farmer. The agriculture industry is huge in Northeast Indiana. And I talked to a small farmer who literally gets up at 3:30 in the morning to haul hogs, gets on his tractor, starts plowing his fields, and tells me that he's barely making it work. This is a guy who is a strong, Christian, conservative, hardworking American that because of our economy, because of the federal government regulations, he's having a hard time just raising hogs, farming his farm, and feeding his family. So those two would probably be the most sensitive heart issues that I've seen. Since I've come off the bench, I have been able to speak more freely with the families of fentanyl addicts. So that's been really, really hard.
Thank you. Marlon, what concerns you, breaks your heart as you travel the district?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. Thank you. Because I think that's really what should be at the heart for all of us is who are serving. I grew up on a farm. I grew up in poverty. I didn't know we were poor until the government told us we were. I joke that my parents took us home to a trailer and we couldn't even afford a park. But America is the greatest country in the world for upward mobility, to grow out of poverty into the middle class, to do something amazing. And so the two people that I think about are young people and also those who grew up in poverty. Because first of all, with young people, I enjoy going to schools and talking to young people about the future, because there's so much optimism and so much energy. And sadly, I'm hearing more and more young people that are depressed and more mental illness. In fact, my son came home the other day and said that his best friend's sister, who was 12 years old, committed suicide. We have to bring hope back to the young people. You know, those who grew up in poverty, it's hard to break out of poverty sometimes, but when we reach out, I think of my friend who's helping a young boy right now, who he doesn't have a good, strong family structure, and he's helping him find his worth and his value, and he's smiling, and he loves working. And so I would say young people and people that are in tough financial circumstances, those are the ones that I would really focus on.
Tim Smith, same question. Where does your compassion travel?
I grew up in New Haven. My dad was a preacher. I went to New Haven High School. I came to this university. I went to IU Law School. I got a job in Fort Wayne for an insurance company. I've been here my entire life. I'm 55. I would have told you 5 years ago that I had my finger on the pulse of the social problems in America. Educated person, I read a lot. About 4 years ago, I made a decision to change careers. Today, I'm the CEO of a Christian nonprofit that focuses on disadvantaged youth and families. We are in all 92 counties, helping about 10,000 families a year. I cannot tell you that I had no idea the depths of the mental health challenges across the state of Indiana, youth and adults alike. I had no idea that we have 2,500 children across the state of Indiana where a judge has terminated parental rights, which is a difficult thing, who have no hope of family. This is the greatest honor in my life, to help these kids with their mental health, to help kids who don't have families find families, and to overcome the most horrendous abuse imaginable to man. It's a great question. I'm honored to help these kids who are disadvantaged, and I look forward to helping them.
Andy, same question.
Thank you for the question, Dirk, and it's certainly something that's near and dear to my heart, and it builds on a lot of what's already been said. But what I simply believe is it's time to reignite the American dream. Having been a father and parents of teenagers now for 15 years, we've had or more, honestly, we've had the opportunity to interact with a lot of our family members' friends, and just this past year, I was with some of my son's friends, and in provoking conversation, because teenage boys aren't exactly chatty, so you have to lead them along a little bit, but it was devastating to think about what was coming for them just after high school here in a few months. One of the questions was, you know, if the world comes to an end, what are you going to eat? You know, what's the meal? What's the food? What's the dining experience you want to have tonight to wrap up your existence here in the world? And one of them said, oh, anything at a gas station is fine. And that really hit home. That is a dream of a 17, 18-year-old boy looking at being on their own in less than a year. As a public servant, I own accountability for that. We've got to make sure we're igniting that dream and that same opportunity that's available to my children is available to every child in Northeast Indiana, in Indiana, and throughout our country. We've got to ignite that dream and make that a possibility for every child.
Thanks to the four of you.
Okay. I want to ask a question that some people in Northeast Indiana worry about, which is Cardinals Cubs. Why are so many? Oh no, different place. I'm sorry.
I was like, oh no, I'm going to fail on this one.
Actually, I want to talk about environmental protection and climate change. These are two subjects that you're going to have to deal with as a congressperson. Do you have any proposals about, do you have a stance on both of these issues? And do you have any proposals about either controlling or enhancing or whatever? And let's start with Marlon Stutzman.
All right, thank you. Well, first of all, you know, growing up on a farm, mm-hmm. the environment is critical for agriculture. Mm-hmm. The agriculture is critical for all of us, for healthy food, for for clean water. And I believe that America leads the world when it comes to making sure that we are leaving this earth better than what we found it. I don't believe that we should be putting ourselves at such a disadvantage. I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in Washington, D.C. when it comes to electric vehicles, you know, mandates. And how are we going to power, 100 million electric vehicles? That power has to come from somewhere. I believe that that nuclear power should really be part of our conversation, and that we can have micro facilities of nuclear power that is clean energy that could power greater parts of the United States. I think that subsidizing all of this, this green energy is not the right solution. Here in Northeast Indiana, we're actually one of the biggest manufacturing districts in the country. District 2 in Indiana is a large manufacturing district, and also up in Wisconsin. We have to make sure that our companies have the energy available to them that produces and can support our families here with great paying jobs. And so I think we're putting ourselves at a disadvantage when we don't hold other countries to the same standards. And we're not irresponsible. But I do believe that nuclear power should be part of our conversation.
Thank you. Tim Smith?
As a Christian, I think it's God's charge to us to take care of the environment. And I'm happy to. As a hunter, I'm a conservationist. As a fisherman, I'm a conservationist. God's given us one environment, we need to take care of it. I don't think there's much debate as to whether the climate's changing. The question is, why is the climate changing, and how has it changed historically? I don't believe all of the hoopla today that we are causing all of the change. If you look at trends over centuries, it's been changing forever. Furthermore, if America decides to curtail its own environmental issues through regulation, and China and India don't, a few billion people aren't helping, and a few hundred million people are doing all the work, and it's one globe, one climate. Look, we're $35 trillion in debt, and that's the third time I've said that in the last hour. We cannot afford to issue regulations and try to fix everything. We cannot afford to capture everybody's carbon and make sure they personally fund their carbon footprints. We just can't afford it. The subsidies in solar, the subsidies in battery, with the goal of becoming more environmentally friendly, are too expensive. We can't afford them. And guess what? The battery cars aren't working anyways when it's 20 below in Chicago. And the solar panels don't get sun 24 hours a day. We just need to think through the solutions a little bit more, even though we have one planet and we need to take care of it.
Thank you. Andy Zay.
Fred, thank you very much for the question. As a ranking member of the Environmental Committee in the Senate and a longtime member on the Utilities Committee, these are issues that we've bantered back and forth. First of all, to Mr. Stutzman's point, we have set laws and rules in place where we can begin to implement small modular nuclear reactors. And so everyone doesn't go into panic. This is what we've been running our ships on since the 60s. It is a very proven technology that is a very clean and green and the most clean, green, and reliable energy source of the future. We certainly need to do that. And we need to get the government heck out of the way. The only reason we're having solar debates in all our communities, the only reason we're having windmill debates in all our communities is because the thumb is on the scale. The federal government is incentivizing this to happen in our communities. We need an all of the above proposition in energy, but it needs to be fair and it needs to be able to compete in the marketplace. And environmentally, we are great stewards. We are the best stewards of our environment here in the United States of America. But what is the cost? And what is going to be the cost of lives, livestock, if we're not careful? And what I share with you now is that we have had 12 baseload power plants that we are in the middle of that are closing in the state of Indiana, and only one of them going online. There was a peak event 2 years ago just before Christmas that we were going to have blackouts across the Midwest. That can't happen. We've got to continue to produce electricity like we know how. We were the 10th most affordable state in electricity just a few years ago, and now we are down in the 30s. It is costing us nearly and dearly as a manufacturing economy to provide the resources that our employers need.
Thank you. Wendy?
You know, Fred, I've said I'm running to bring back a strong America, and it's hard, no disrespect, for me to sit here and have a conversation about environmental protections and climate change when our world is on fire, our America is on fire, because we've got wide open border chaos, we've got crime out of control, and we've got an economy that's out of control because of needless spending. But I will tell you this. I, too, grew up on a small farm. My dad worked in agriculture. And I can tell you, after talking to so many farmers around the Northeast Indiana 3rd District, as well as the farmer that farmed our land, these farmers take care of their environment. We don't need overregulations like WOTUS to tell a grain farmer, you know, when they can regulate a water puddle. That's crazy. And I support, I mean, if you look at not only our farmers and livestock production, right? Like I mentioned earlier, there's lawsuits that the EPA wants to shut down livestock production because of emissions in the wake of this environmental protection. That's crazy. You know, I too am a strong Christian. God gave us this earth. What I've seen around the district, the farmers take great care of our environment. They don't need to be overregulated. And even the ethanol plants, they're capturing the carbons. People are doing, if the federal government would stay out, we don't need a Green New Deal. We don't need battery-operated cars. Now, it's a free market. If I want to buy a battery-operated car, that's on me. But it should not be mandated. And I would say the farmers and most Americans take care of the environment.
All right. Thank you for your answer.
Good news, gang. We've reached the end. I've got your final question. And allow me to just say I'm proud of all of you for being so friendly and keeping it civil thus far. Let's see if we can hang on to that through this last question here. Tim, we're going to be starting with you for this one. You are one of 8 Republican candidates. If you do not win on May 7th, and given all of these PAC ads that we've got going on right now, is there anything that would keep you from endorsing and supporting the nominee?
No. In other words, I'm happy to support the nominee. And I'm also glad you mentioned the PAC ads. I am the only person on this stage who hasn't accepted a penny from a PAC, which can give you up to $5,000, or had a super PAC, which can spend on an unlimited basis on behalf of the candidate. None of them are actively supporting Tim Smith. Marlon just got a $540,000 investment on his behalf from a super PAC yesterday. Marlon claims to be pro-Trump. The super PAC that supported Marlon is absolutely anti-Trump and spent millions of dollars in Iowa to beat him. Wendy is supported by a super PAC called Winning for Women. She claims to be pro-Trump. Her super PAC was incredibly anti-Trump during the presidential election. I think election security is one of our biggest problems. Look, if a super PAC or a PAC is giving you tens of thousands or spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on your behalf, you have to wonder why. Why are they doing that? It's actually related to the pork we talked about earlier. If someone came to me and said, look, I'm anti-Trump, I want to support you, I'd be really concerned as to why they want to support me. Maybe I'm not as pro-Trump as I thought. I'm proud to have been the first person to endorse Trump. Proud to have been the first person to say I was an America First candidate. And very proud to say when I get to Washington, D.C., I will be beholden to no one.
I'm going to grant 2 rebuttals. So before we get to Andy, Marlon, I want to start with you. Your name was mentioned first. You've got a 30-second rebuttal if you choose to what Tim just said.
I would say that the PAC that he's referencing is a conservative PAC. You know, a lot of this is stemmed from the PAC that Wendy is associated with that started negative ads on me 2 weeks ago. And, you know, name calling and all these other things. So, I'm focused on Washington. I'm fighting Washington because I've been there. I know the traps. I know it's a swamp. And I'm going to go back and I'm going to stand firm on my conservative credentials. I'm endorsed by Jim Jordan, Rand Paul. I'm endorsed by the pro-life groups. And, you know, my record stands for itself. I was the most conservative member of the Indiana delegation.
Okay, that's your time. Thank you, Marlon. Wendy, to you, granting you double rebuttals because your name was mentioned twice by both Tim and Marlon, so I'm going to need 60 seconds on the clock. Wendy?
So just to be clear, I have not accepted one penny from Winning for Women. Winning for Women endorsed me because of three reasons. I'm a Republican, conservative woman. So that's my, I haven't received any money for them. The ads they ran, I had nothing to do with that, and Marlon knows that. The ads that Marlon's PACs are running are a lie, and I think that it shows Marlon's a hypocrite because I've gotten beat up for this. I put into place when I was a judge, I got awards for putting drug dealers and violent offenders in prison, and I got an award under Mike Pence because I was on his statewide drug task force for starting the HOPE probation program. So they're just coming up with this. But the PAC that the ads that the PAC was running on my behalf, they were just facts on Marlon, on him voting to raise taxes, on him using campaign dollars for vacation, on him making sure he voted to defund the very agency that's supposed to fund our borders, and for him voting to double his salary. So those were facts. But what they're using against me is just pure hypocrisy and untrue.
Time. Thank you, Wendy. Marlon, I am going to, because I'm feeling generous, I'm going to also grant you the 30-second rebuttal, but I do not want this to go on forever with the four of you. So, Marlon, go ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, the PAC, Winning for Women, is predominantly funded by Melinda Gates. This is not a conservative PAC. This is a liberal PAC. I never met with them. Wendy did. But, you know, the fact is that I am a conservative fighting Washington. I'm being attacked. I was attacked by Wendy's PACs for 2 weeks, and she says it was factual. Why call me sleazy then? Why call me swampy? Why call me names? You know, the people of the 3rd District deserve better than that. Let's focus on the problems in Washington, D.C. rather than attack your opponent.
Thank you, Marlon. Andy, we will come to you. We'll move this along because, like I said, I know we could talk about that forever. And
yeah,
let me repeat the question.
You said my name again. I just want to make sure people understand.
You've gone back and forth, guys. We get it.
People understand.
You brought the swamp to Indiana. Let's move on.
I didn't call him those names. So
we'll come back to that. We can move on for the moment. Andy, I do want to come to you with this final question. I'm going to read it again to refresh everyone's memory here. If, you know, you're one of the eight candidates, if it comes down to it and you do not win on May 7th, is there anything that you've heard, whether it's from a PAC ad or what have you, that would keep you from supporting the nominee?
Well, Kayla, thank you very much for the question. Thank you for making this the last question so we didn't start here. clearly, we brought Washington to the 3rd District, and we have two candidates that have done that. And, you know, I distinguish myself from the others in that. I am appealing to the voters of the 3rd District. I have today. I have in the past. I have been a proud member of the Republican Party for over 30 years, serving as a precinct committeeman, serving as a vice chair and treasurer of my local party, serving at the state convention for 6 to 8 conventions, and serving at the national convention in 2016. Will I endorse the winner of this race? Absolutely. Do I like where we're at right now? No. I don't think we need to bring the swamp to Northeast Indiana, and we clearly have in this race. I will stay above the fray. I will represent my record to the folks of the 3rd District. We have knocked on 20,000 doors. We have made over 20,000 phone calls, and we're pushing forward with that. We'll continue to do that and ask for the 3rd District voters because I think they're the ones that should be deciding this race, not the influences, not the swamp of D.C. And, you know, I'll stand on that. And that's a campaign we decided to run 341 days ago, and we're going to continue that all the way to May 7th. And with that, it's going to bring us home successfully because I think the people of the 3rd District want to elect their representative, not have Washington, D.C. tell them who they should vote for.
Thank you, Andy. Wendy, we are back to you. Take it away.
Yes, I will absolutely support whoever the nominee is. I think as Republicans, we need to quit fighting each other. I will say that the PAC that's come in for me is not a special interest PAC. They don't want anything from me. I haven't taken a cent, nor did I have anything to do with those. But I do have to address, I mean, I appreciate Andy Zay saying, I stand on my record. Andy voted to raise the gas tax. I will not vote to raise any taxes, and I would employ anybody to dig into my past, dig into my professional career, because everything I did as a judge, everything that I all the decisions I've made, even the opinions that I wrote, are all public knowledge. So I would just say have everybody do their own research on the candidates, but I can say right now that I will not vote to ever raise any taxes. That being said, I will support the nominee.
Wendy, thank you. Marlon, sit tight. Andy, your name was just mentioned, so I'd also like to grant you a 30-second rebuttal.
Well, I was wondering how long it would take for the user fee to come out on gases. But, you know, we are the crossroads of America. It was a tough debate. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that we emboldened our local communities, our commissioners and our mayors. And to date, I think we've partnered with them collaboratively to, you know, embolden our crossroads of America. We have invested $1.5 billion in our community crossings program that's come back to our communities. It was a tough vote, and I think it was the right thing to do. And I stand by that vote. And along with that, you know, we've eliminated the inheritance tax. We've lowered the income tax to its lowest level ever. And we are on the right track in the state of Indiana.
Thank you, Andy. Marlon, last but not least, once again, come May 7th, if you are not the winner of the race, will you support the nominee?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I truly believe that any four of us it would be much better than any Democrat that would be elected. Unfortunately, the Democrat Party is who is ruining America by spending. We have our own problems in the party, in our party. And I have always been a strong conservative. That's why I have strong conservative support from Congressman Jim Jordan, Senator Rand Paul, folks in the Freedom Caucus. I have a strong base of support from conservatives. And I think that, you know, to answer the question, yes, I would absolutely support any one of them. We have got to elect President Trump back to the White House. What Jim, or what Joe Biden has done to the country over the past 4 years is unbelievable. From 2020 with the mishandling of COVID to 2021 when we had a shortage of folks going back to work because of government spending to 2022 and inflation. Interest rates are at all-time highs for my generation, and to see the cost of living just continue to go through the roof is why I'm running again. I'm a business owner. I've seen those costs at a restaurant go through the roof, but I also know that for our employees, that is an important job for them. I've had employees come up to me and say, thank you for staying open through tough times. Thank you for doing whatever you have to do to stay open. And because this is an important job for them, and I am always excited to expand and grow our companies because that's more jobs for Hoosiers.
Thank you, Marlon.
That wraps up the questions. We give you each 60 seconds to close. There is no rebuttal, so please try to keep it sane. Andy, we start with you.
Do I get started? All right. Very good. Well, thank you very much, moderators from our hosting today, Purdue Fort Wayne. And it's just great to be here in a public forum to speak to the voters of the 3rd District, because it's the voters of the 3rd District that deserve the right to pick their next congressman. And we need to be focused on that. We need to be focused on the hard work, the creativity that I brought to this campaign to look at things differently. And I assure you, as a legislator in Washington, D.C., I will do the same thing. It's not just no. It's just not saying no to legislation. It's the creativity and it's the perseverance of driving beyond no to get to solutions that a majority of members can get behind. I have done that in the Indiana Senate on a number of different policies, and I will do that in Washington, D.C., because my commitment to you is to serve the people of the 3rd District today, tomorrow, and into the future. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for receiving me in your homes, on your doorsteps, on your phones, and I look forward to closing strong and being your next U.S. Congressman from the 3rd District. Andy Zay, vote Zay in May.
Wendy Davis.
So I'm former Judge Wendy Davis, congressional candidate as well, and I am running to bring back a strong America alongside Donald Trump. I, too, endorsed Donald Trump way before the Iowa caucus. And you've heard my story. I've seen a lot of American Biden's and failed policies in my courtroom. And I solved problems. And again, that's all, whether I put fentanyl addicts into programs or put drug dealers and illegals that are committing crimes into prison. I want to pivot now in how I solve problems in my courtroom. I want to solve those same problems in Washington, D.C. As a judge, I could not kick the can down the road. I had to make decisions and move on. I will do that for Northeast Indiana as a conservative leader. Jim Banks has done a phenomenal job. I will pick up the mantle where Jim Banks has laid it down, and I will ensure that I represent the 3rd District. There's a lot of diversity in the 3rd District with different issues, and I will work with President Trump to bring back a strong America.
Marlon Stutzman.
Well, first of all, thank you for the debate, and thank you to my competitors as well for participating. This has been a great conversation and one that I believe that the voters of the 3rd District deserve. And
talking about challenges and problems that we have. We live in the greatest country in the world, in the United States of America, but we have people in Washington, D.C. that are ruining America with spending. $35 trillion in debt, we'll say it again, because that, I believe, is the greatest threat to the United States. We have threats in China. We have threats around the world. You know, people are attacking our ally in Israel. We have a southern border that is open, and we have got to finish the wall to make sure that we keep the American people safe. It is it's Washington, D.C. that's failing Americans. I've been there before. I know the swamp. I know how the swamp works. They are selfish and greedy, and I believe that it's time to send people of faith. I believe that our hope is in Christ, and that's where we're going to find true victory. And I believe that we as the American people, if we stand together, we can win America back.
And Tim Smith.
I think America has always been the greatest country in the world, and I still think it is today. I'm running because I think it's at risk. The people of Indiana 3 should understand that they have a choice between insiders and outsiders. Candidates who are being bought and paid for by super PACs, and one who has received no money, either directly or indirectly, by super PACs. Earlier we talked about pork, and we talked about how hard it is to get things done, but special projects are bought and paid for. When a super PAC comes in with hundreds of thousands of dollars on behalf of the candidate, we should ask why. When the same super PACs opposed President Trump with millions and tens of millions of dollars in the primaries, we should ask why. How can a candidate be pro-Trump and accept all the money the super PACs are doing? I'm Tim Smith. I'm running for Congress to be an independent outside voice to end wokeness and expand freedom.
On behalf of Fred, Kayla, and me, I want to say thanks to the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics, the Center for Collaborative Media, and College TV for recording all of this. And thank you to the four candidates here. We know there's other opportunities to see all eight of you at the same time, and we appreciate those opportunities being made. There's a small crowd here. If you could thank our candidates for their time this afternoon, I think that would be appropriate. Thank you again.
Podcasts by Federated Media.